You're listening to Expand the Curve, and I'm your host, Olive Bassey. Here we discuss controversial topics within plus-size representation in all industries, along with real-life stories from everyday people. In order for change to occur, you must be the change. Let's contract the norms and expand the curve. Welcome back, everyone. It's your host, Olive Bassey, and I have a fantastic guest I have the pleasure introducing. Her name is Reagan. She's a speaker, activist, writer, trained athlete, research, and she is like truly a jack of all trades, you guys. Like, she's doing it all. She previously held the title for Guinness World Record for heaviest woman to compete in a marathon, which I was like, wow, okay. We love that for you. How are you today?
I am doing super awesome. How are you doing today?
I'm having a day. Yeah, it's been a wild one, but I'm happy to be speaking with you, honestly.
Likewise.
Yes. I give you a little introduction here, but do you want to like give us a well-rounded introduction of yourself?
Sure. So professionally, I'm a speaker and writer. My background is in research methods and statistics. And so I talk to general audiences about things like dealing with diet culture, focusing on weight neutral health, dealing with weight stigma. And then I talk to professional audiences about things like creating inclusive fitness spaces, and then to healthcare practitioners about best practices for working with higher weight patients. And as you mentioned, in my free time, I like to do like ridiculous fitness things. And so I am a triathlete. I was a 3-time dance champion, and I currently hold the Guinness record for heaviest woman to complete a marathon. And I do want to say, I think it's really important to understand, because there's this idea of like good fatty, bad fatty dichotomy, like fat people who participate in fitness get a certain amount of privilege for doing that we shouldn't get. And so I always want to be really clear. This is something that I like to do, but it, like, completing a marathon and watching a Netflix marathon are morally equivalent activities. And so this idea of the good fatty, bad fatty dichotomy really needs to die, and I want to help kill it. And I do benefit from privilege from it. So I always want to talk about that when I talk about fitnessy things.
Of course. I love that. I wanted to ask, how long did it take, like, training wise to get up to completing that marathon?
So my first marathon, I trained for 20 weeks. That wasn't the Guinness one. And then the second one, I decided that the part of the marathon was like pushing outside of my comfort zone and doing things. Because I always played sports since I was a little kid, but I only ever did stuff that I was good at immediately. So I played basketball once in fifth grade, sucked at it, and never played. And so I was like, I really, as an athlete, don't know much about myself outside of my own comfort zone. And so the marathon was like doing that, because I hate endurance stuff. I'm like a fast twitch athlete. And so I decided to do an iron distance triathlon to push that farther. And so I trained for the second one as part of that.
Oh, wow. Oh my God. That's incredible. I just struggle going up the stairs, but that's what stair climber is for me. Honestly, I'm building it up again, honestly, but that's amazing. Wow. But when you, I guess my question is, did Guinness World Records, did you contact them, or did they contact you regarding this?
So after I finished my first marathon, somebody said, hey, did you know, like, the Guinness World Record holder, currently the category is, it's just a dude who holds it. And so you could create a category for cis women and then compete in that. And I would really like them to see them create like categories around trans and non-binary folks as well, because there's no representation for that within the way that they structure things typically. And so I wrote to Guinness and made an application. And I thought that I would just send them the proof. Look, I did a marathon. They'd be, here's your medal. No, you have to do it separately. You have to jump through a ton of hoops. It doesn't cost anything necessarily, or very little, to do it the way we did. Like, you can have an adjudicator on site, and that's thousands of dollars. There's no way I could afford that. So we had to have like witnesses every 2 hours, two different witnesses, like writing down. And literally, they're just watching me walk and run in the rain for 2 hours. So these people were like heroic. My partner was like in the back of a van coordinating. I'd have a GoPro on at all times to like, so somebody at Guinness watched 10 hours of me walking and running in the rain.
That's time they'll never get back.
So she was... No, right? This is this person's job. I feel so bad. But like, my partner was a complete hero in coordinating all this, and had a different sign at every lap that I came back. Like, it was so sweet. And my friends had like created, it was really sweet. But it took a lot to get. I had to be weighed in on a scale that weighed me to the gram. And then we had to do a calculation of the pull of gravity at that specific latitude and longitude point. So like the awesome woman who weighed me, Teresa, also got this person involved. Like, she did the weigh-in, got this physics professor involved. So part of my application is a math equation I don't understand at all.
Wow.
It was, yeah, it was like a thing.
Oh my God. I feel like you created a new like scientific formula for this. Like, oh my God.
I think it was there. I just didn't know anything. Yeah. Like, I didn't know you could calculate the pull of gravity at a specific latitude and longitude point, but here we are.
That's incredible. Oh my God.
Yeah.
How, once you've got that title, how received within the public and the community? Like, people were very proud of you. People were like, oh, I don't really care for this, or like, it was mixed.
I got a lot of positive feedback. I didn't really do a ton of media because I didn't want to say I did it until I was sure I did it. And it took, because we didn't pay money, it took 15 weeks from the time I finished the marathon to get it certified. So 15 weeks is a lifetime. Who cares that I ran a marathon 15 weeks ago? And so I, like, my goal in creating and setting this record and doing all of this was just in the fitness world to create space, like, with my physical body for fat people. So my hope was, if I have this record, then other people will be like, oh, let me try to break it. And that was my goal. So it wasn't like, it's cool to have the record. I love medals. I'm not going to lie, like, cross finish line, get medal and banana, that's a good day for me. But really, it was a big part of it was like creating space in the fitness world for fat people. Because I hear all the time, I get emails every day from someone who's like, I didn't think I could dance, or I didn't think I could do a 5K until I saw somebody my size doing it. And so this was a way to be like, look, like, it's official, certified, this happened. And there are people who are bigger than me out there doing marathons for sure, and ultra marathons, and not jumping through the Guinness hoops, which is totally fine. That's a barrier, but just to have that space created. So I got pretty positive feedback from that. There are some people who are like, who cares? And I agree, this isn't. And it, again, it goes back to that good fatty, bad fatty, that you have to be really careful that you're not saying I'm better than those other fat people because I participate in fitness. Because we live in a culture that's also healthist on top of being fat phobic. And so that's an easy thing to do. And so trying to be really specific about that has been a big part of talking about it.
No, yeah. And I completely agree. It's, for us to be a positive community, we have to realize where our weaknesses are, and the good and bad fatty kind of thing. That's just, it's such a huge spectrum, and we need to like condense it and make it more neutralized, that we're all on the same page. We're all on the same team. And I feel like we forget that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's easy to try to push somebody else down to get yourself up a little bit. And that's one of the ways that people who participate in like fitness or quote unquote healthy behaviors can do that, either in like consciously and intentionally, or subconsciously or unintentionally, like just taking that little bit of approval from mainstream culture that we get, even though it harms people who are doing other things with their time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. You recently said you were a speaker too as well, and you've done like big conferences. I saw you spoke with Google and all these other ones. How do you like, how did you get into that? And like, how did you get the confidence? Because I would love that.
So I, per my mom, came out of the factory with the confidence. Like, I've always just like, public speaking has never been something that I didn't like or that I shied away from. And from the earliest ages, I really felt like if something didn't seem right or fair to me, I was going to say something about it, and it didn't really matter. And so I had done a lot of activism work. I, like, my first protest I staged was in kindergarten, essentially against nap time. But so I did some activism in high school. In college, I started to do a lot of activism in queer and trans community and solidarity work in anti-racism. And I, like, speaking was something that came naturally to me and was a way that was clear that like I could have some impact and be effective. And so then when I started blogging, I was working as a operations consultant, a business operations consultant, when I started the Dances with Fat blog, and was just wanting to write about my experiences as a fat ballroom dancer. And then started thinking about it more globally and in terms of being part of a community that is oppressed as a part of, as opposed to, oh, it's just a me personally thing. And so I wrote a lot, and then I started to get invitations to speak. And I was speaking as an operations consultant. Like, I would give talks about like creating administrative systems that make sense for your work style and that kind of thing. And that was really fun. But I was like, here's a chance to do work that like, that has a real impact on people's lives. Like, it's cool to help somebody sell 50 more widgets. It's totally a different thing for somebody to say, I didn't know these options existed, and now I do.
Yeah.
So.
Absolutely. And I feel, like you said, you've always had this confidence, but like, when did you really, like, what age did you really think that you started to find your purpose in like being a speaker and being this researcher and being like this wealth of knowledge and like a jack of all trades, essentially? Because I feel like for some people, it starts later on in life, because when you're younger, you're still figuring things out.
Yeah, so it's gone a wobbly path. Like, I went to college on an orchestra scholarship, and I wanted to be a professional clarinet player. I had wanted to do that since like fifth or sixth grade. I had been practicing like 4, 5, 6 hours a day since then. Went to school on a music scholarship and got to play Carnegie Hall, which was amazing, and realized that that was not the life I wanted. Because you don't really get to choose where you play. You don't really get to choose what kind of music you play. Like, you're just, it's so hard to find a job as a professional clarinet player, because I didn't want to teach. It's not my gift. And I didn't want to be one of those people who's like, they couldn't make a living playing, so they turn to teaching, then they get bitter and they're not like supporting. So I moved to I had been doing a ton of activism within, like I said, queer and trans community I was at the University of Texas. And this is like the mid 90s in Texas, but UT was like the liberal university. And so we had a huge for the time, queer and trans students organization. And I was on the board of that and doing work with student government. And so I moved over to the School of Social Work. But I didn't want to do clinical social work. Again, an incredible gift, not my gift. And so I did geeky social work, right? Administration, policy, research methods, statistics. And then I ended up stumbling because I wanted to do nonprofit work, and I was doing that on a volunteer basis, and stumbled into consulting as like a something that I could do from. And so was building all of those skills, understanding like corporate America and the nonprofit side. And then my speaking and writing I was doing for corporate work. I did a couple self-published books for my corporate work. And then, so when I started to do the blog, like this was all like a confluence of this whole wobbly path coming to where I had this research methods and statistics background. So I could really look at the research around weight and health and understand it, where I had been honing my ability to explain complicated concepts in ways that were accessible to folks who didn't have that background. And I had this speaking that I had always liked and writing that I always enjoyed. And so it really was a confluence of all the skills that I have. And then my personality, there's a lot of internet trolls and stuff that comes at you. And I just happen, for whatever reason, privilege and luck, to be resilient at that. And so it really helped me push through. So it's a confluence of weird personality traits and learning.
No, and that's what makes you so unique. And that's why I gravitated towards your like website, your Instagram. It's just, I can see all this information, but I can also see your personality truly shine. Even like you do like monthly workshops and your newsletters. It's just, I can see all of this information, but I can also see like how like diverse and well-rounded everything is. But also you really show what it really means to be fat and plus size and to be accepting of it. Because that's what I really like the most. I feel like it's a struggle. I have my days where I'm like, I regret it. But then other days I'm like, you know what? I love my body. Like, why not? And I know for you, like that probably was a journey because you've done like the whole training, the athlete. I feel like when you're an athlete, there's always a portion of you that feels like you're always going to like somewhat lose weight. Did you ever, like when you were training and stuff, did you feel like you were going to lose weight? Like you weren't going to get this title anymore or...
No, I didn't. The thing is, because I started with the research, I actually started looking for the best diet. I was still in diet culture and I was like, and I had done a bunch of diets that like, in fact, doctors had prescribed to me, and I had yo-yoed back and lose weight, gain weight, lose weight, gain weight. And so I was like, I've never really brought my skills to bear on this. So I have the time. I'm going to do a full literature review of every study I can find on weight loss methods, and I'm going to find the best one. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm trying to best diet. And I did this literature review, and I had hours and hours reading these studies. And I got to the end and I was like, holy crap, not a single one of these has more than a tiny fraction of people succeeding at significant long-term weight loss. And I was so surprised because besides white supremacy, this idea that like I could lose weight if I wanted to and it would make me healthier had been sold to me more aggressively than anything in my life. And so I went back and I did that literature review again. And I was like doing calculations by hand and like I thinking like I must have missed something, but I hadn't. And so that, because I came to it through that, I knew it wasn't like somebody told me, oh, you're probably not going to lose weight. It was like, no, it's not going to happen. Like it hasn't happened by now. I'm looking at the proof that it's not going to happen. And so that's what got me started in looking at what else is understanding health is not an obligation. It's not a barometer of worthiness. It's certainly not entirely within our control. What if it's not weight loss that would support my body? Then, and so I went down that path. But so as I would move, people would say, oh, if you're training for this marathon, you might not be the heaviest woman anymore, hardy har. And I was like, actually, the research suggests that I will. Like one of the worst ways to even short-term create that short-term weight loss that people get before they regain it is through fitness shows a ton of benefits to the body in research, but not a lot of weight loss. And so unfortunately, what people do is say, oh, then maybe you should do not as much fitness and more like food restriction or whatever, instead of just saying, look at the health benefits that you could get if that's of interest to you, and knowing that your mileage may vary. But it's always, because I think I started in the research, it gave me like this big advantage of being able to, when you get that pull of maybe just try one more time at dieting, I'm like, it's not going to work. Like, you better show me a study that says something different than all the other studies, because it's just not going to work. And so I think that has been really, like, in my journey, helpful to me, because I was so like firm and clear on that. So I could build everything else on top of that understanding.
Yeah. I think I remember, I don't quote me on the numbers, but there was a statistic of a person that's trying to lose weight that they go through how many diets. It's over like 50. Like, they go through so many diets. And I just think about it and I'm like, there's no way I've gone through that many. But then I'm thinking about it, I was like, I have tried a lot of diets now that I really think yeah. about it. I'm just like, why is it so high? And why is it diet culture and diet industry so, I feel like it's so radically charged more than ever. Is there any plausible like findings from it, or?
Profit yes. is why. So what the diet industry knew from the beginning, like if you go and get a Weight Watchers actual paper filing when they incorporated, they knew that most people would lose weight short term and gain it back long term. And so what this actually is, how the body reacts to food restriction, right? Because our bodies are geared to survive. So they don't have a sense that like, I'm giving you hunger signals, you're not feeding me. That's because you want me to look more like a stereotype of beauty, right? It's, if I'm hungry and you're not feeding me, I guess there's not food. And then you go run on a treadmill and it's, oh, there's no food and I have to run from bears. I've got you. I will fix this. And so then our bodies do all of these things physiologically with hormones, with the way that muscle is distributed, to become weight regaining, weight maintaining machines. Because what we teach them through dieting is we go through times of famine and bear running from bears. And in that instance, like, you need to be ready for that with stores. And so our bodies physiologically change in response to dieting. And what the weight loss industry did was, understanding that, they got in front of it by saying, oh, no, people lose weight short term and gain it back long term because they just can't maintain the habits. And so they got people to credit them with the short term weight loss, but blame themselves, the dieters, for the long term weight gain, even though those are both part of the same biological response. And so this drives massive profit to the diet industry because we go back. So like, when I talk about Weight Watchers, their own research shows that the average client loses 10 pounds in year one, gains back 5 pounds in year two. And they did a common research trick, which is then they just stopped counting at year two and said, see, everybody's below their original weight. And like, fun fact about research, I would have failed freshman research methods if I pulled that. You cannot do that. If the trajectory is going straight up, you're not allowed just to stop counting and go, I'm sure it leveled off right there. That's not how that works. But that's exactly what they did. And then you'll never see a Weight Watchers commercial, join Weight Watchers and stand a decent chance of losing 5 pounds in 2 years. So even though but that's what their research says. So they know very well what happens to their average client, and they work really hard to obfuscate that and to get people to blame them. And so I'll talk about this when I give talks, and inevitably a fat person will come down at the end and say, you shouldn't talk bad about Weight Watchers because I did it 6 times and it worked for me every time. And it is, yeah, like, I just slow blink it because I don't want to make them feel bad because they've been duped by diet culture. This is not their fault. But if I pay somebody to not be fat 6 times and I'm standing here fat right now, I'm not going to defend that. Certainly not to a professional speaker who just did a thing with charts and graphs. But we're so bought into this idea that it's not Weight Watchers that failed. It's me. It's not the diet. And the truth is, it's not dieters who fail. It's the diets that are prescribed to them, often by healthcare practitioners. On about 95% of people who attempt weight loss gain back all of their weight. Up to 66% of those gain back more than they lost. And I don't think there's anything wrong with being fat or getting fatter. I do think there's something wrong with something that's treated like a healthcare intervention that has the opposite of the intended effect the majority of the time.
Yes. Yeah. Those numbers, oh my God, thank you. Because I knew about Weight Watchers, but I didn't realize how much of a vicious cycle it is. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Wow.
I was just going to say, what I talk to healthcare providers about a lot is that, so we've got this thing, right, where we tell people to try to lose weight. And then they lose weight short term and gain it back long term. That's not benign. So that process is called weight cycling or yo-yo dieting, is associated with things like increased inflammation, increased cardiac incidence. It's basically correlated with the same health issues that get correlated to having a higher weight body. And so what happens is, when we research the health outcomes for fat people, we make this assumption that, oh, if fat people have a health issue more often than thin people, it must be because of their body size. But in fact, when we look, weight stigma, weight cycling, and healthcare inequalities, which are things that almost all fat people are subjected to in our culture, are correlated with those same health issues. And so our healthcare system creates those things and then blames fat bodies for the negative harms that come out of it.
Oh my God. It's the holiday season, and we know how hectic it can be trying to shop for gifts, especially when you're on a budget. I was constantly trying to find discount codes, wasting so much time and energy. Well, no more. Honey does the work for me. How? Their tool automatically finds and applies coupon codes on 40,000 popular sites. One click is all it takes. It's completely free and easy to use. All you have to do is download the browser extension, then visit your favorite online stores, and Honey does its magic. Your holiday shopping just got a whole lot easier. Go to joinhoney.com/REF/1RC8. That's joinhoney.com/REF/1RC8.
Getting duped in four different ways, honestly.
For real, yeah. For profit all around. Yeah. And not everybody in this process is like profit driven and fully understand this. When I talk to healthcare providers, this is a light bulb moment for them as well. A lot of times, because they've been trained to see a larger body as a pathology. And they've been trained that my job is to get rid of pathologies. And so they're like, my first job is to get this person thin. And they're depending on research, because like people in medical school don't have time to read research. I got to do this because I was not in medical school trying to learn everything else about the human body. And so they're counting on like that conclusion paragraph. And what you'll see is the conclusion will say everyone who complied lost weight. But then when you dig into the study, 64% of people dropped out. Everyone else lost weight but was gaining it back already by the time the study was over, but none of that makes the final conclusion paragraph. So what the doctor hears is, if you, you know, comply, you can lose weight. But that's not what the study said at all. And once again, I say I would have gotten failed hard in research methods had I done this, but this is what the research is around weight and health, is like horrifyingly bad.
Oh my God.
Fail freshman research methods bad, but that's what doctors are depending on.
Yeah.
And often that research is funded by the people who make money.
Exactly. I completely agree. It really is funded by them. Again, like we both said, we didn't really know about like the whole fat acceptance movement, stuff like that. And you having all these statistics, how can the media and society, like how can we as a community bring that kind of awareness? What would you recommend? I know you do speaking in conferences and stuff like that, but as a community, what can we do to really promote and help better ourselves to understand that fat does not mean it's the worst thing in the entire world, you know?
Yeah. So I want to really be super clear. I'm one of many people doing this work, including people who do like research methods and statistics background. So there's a lot of us around. But I think there's a couple things that we have to do. The first thing is we have to be clear that people have the right to exist and thrive, period. Without shame, stigma, bullying, oppression, it doesn't matter why we're fat. It doesn't matter if there are health impacts to being fat. It doesn't matter if we could or even want to become thin. Fat people have the right to exist, period. And so that is the first piece of it. So I talk about like the statistics around weight and health because I want fat people to be supported in their own goals around health. But I also always want to be clear, if you make health a barometer of worthiness, then you're just adding healthism to fat phobia. So that's the first piece. But in terms of the best thing that we could do, the research is incredibly clear. The best thing we could do to support the health of people of all sizes, but fat people in particular, is to work on bringing down barriers to access, which includes things like affordability, transportation, but also things like oppression, experiences of stigma, to increase access, and then to focus on supporting people's, you know, health and bodies at the size they are, rather than focusing on shrinking people to try to make them healthier. So the research is incredibly clear on that. And what we do right now is pathologize fat bodies and say the best path to health is to try to become thin. And that's simply not supported by the evidence.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially with social media. Oh my God. Social media has probably been like, it cuts both ways. Like, you can have it being like the best thing for us, and then it can be an absolutely detrimental. And I wanted to know your thoughts on the body positivity movement, because every guest I've had has been very vocal and I've been loving it. So I just wanted to know what your thoughts are on it with Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, Snapchat, anything really.
Yeah, I have feelings. So the idea of body positivity was started by radical fat activists, many of them women of color, to be about radical fat acceptance. And what has happened over time is the movement has been co-opted by like chunky, affluent white women. And I want chunky, affluent white women to love their bodies. I absolutely do. I just don't think that they're the most in need of assistance. And so what they do is, because they present a much more acceptable, a much closer to the stereotype of beauty image, it's, oh, if I sit a certain way, I can make a roll in my stomach and I've learned to love that roll and yay. And okay, yay. But what happens is it centers their experience and it centers their victories as if they're victories for fat who have far less privilege than they do. And so what happens is somebody goes from making a size 14 to making a size 18 and people act like that's, oh, look, inclusivity. But in fact, the people at the highest weights are still the less likely to be accommodated. And so it centers that much more privileged narrative to the exclusion of the people who are already the least accommodated and the most oppressed. And it also, often you'll find that those people who then get centered push out the people who started the movement. So you'll hear things like, it's okay to be fat as long as you're healthy, as long as it doesn't impact your mobility. And so they bring their ableism and their healthism and their racism and their homophobia and transphobia, and they bring that into body positivity.
Yeah.
So not only have they like co-opted a movement and centered themselves, but they're pushing out the people who created the movement and who need it the most.
Yeah. And when I was reading all this information and learning about the body positivity movement, I was just like, is there no laws or rules behind like our weight discrimination? And then when I looked in further, there's literally no laws regarding weight discrimination. There is for racism, there is for ageism, there's for ableism, but not for weight discrimination. And I'm just like, what? Especially during like high schools and colleges, especially during colleges, because that's when I feel like everyone's experimenting, learning about their bodies, learning about themselves more. But it's pretty bad.
Yeah, there are some places. So in the Bay Area, there is a non-discrimination law. The state of Michigan has non-discrimination based on weight and size, but they're like little piecemeal. And there's work being done to try to get this in at a national level. But yeah, I hear college is a really good example. So I'll hear from somebody who says, I don't fit in the seats in my class. And one person was in law school and she was taking her tests on the steps, like laying down on the steps of her class because she couldn't fit in the desks. And she called the disability office and they said, this isn't a disability, so it's beyond our purview and we don't have to accommodate based on size. And there was just nothing for her to do. Other people have gotten desks, but then if somebody sits in their desk, now they have to kick somebody out of their seat and say, no, this seat is especially for me because I'm not accommodated, which if you're not in a place, our culture tries to make people ashamed of their size and ashamed of feeling like they need accommodation, which what actually happened was they knew fat people existed when they made this place and they left us out. So that's not on us. Like, we shouldn't have to be advocating for a seat that fits us. That should have already been thought about and created. But because we come from this internalized weight stigma and shame, and because other people feel entitled to their weight stigma and shame, asking for accommodation can be incredibly difficult. And then having to fight for that accommodation can make it impossible. And so people are simply not getting the same access. I spoke at a prestigious university, and I was speaking to the dean of students and all of her staff. And it was in a stadium seating room, and I couldn't fit in the seats. And so I stood on the side. I was the third speaker. So I stood for, 40 minutes while the other two people, and the poor gentleman before me was talking about their commitment to inclusivity and radical hospitality. And so as he was coming off, I was like, I'm sorry, I'm about to do this. This is not your fault. But I was like, I wasn't standing out of respect for my colleagues. So I have tremendous respect. I was standing because I can't sit in this room. And that does not feel radically hospitable.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, there's a table in the back. And I couldn't even. And I was like, does this university encourage students to sit in the back out of view of their professors?
Yeah. What kind of Rosa Parks crap is that? No, thank you. I don't need that.
I was like, this is not okay. And like, then those students, how are they going to get a recommendation from their professor who can't even see them? they can't participate in a class discussion if they raise their hand and the professor can't see them. So I was just like, so yeah, there's all of these areas where there's no protection. And the suggestion is, well, if you don't like it, get thinner. Change your body to suit your oppressors. And while I would never compare the two directly, as someone who is both fat and queer, having come out early helped me a lot, because in the 90s in Texas, it was reasonable to say, oh, if you don't like homophobia, like you should really give conversion therapy a shot. And when I was always like, how about no? Like, how about we end homophobia? Let's not try to end gay people. Let's try to end gay oppression. And so I was able to see that parallel for myself as a fat person. But not everybody is. And so there's this idea that, oh, if fatness is the reason for exclusion, then the exclusion is acceptable.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, man, that whole college experience. Oh my God. I've never had something bad, but that to recommend a table, I don't know. I would have been hot-headed at that moment. I'm sorry. You were so calm and collected. I would have not handled that at all. I would have ended terribly, but wow, it's just, it's moments like that, that you really take into the consideration. Wow. My ostracization and my bullying of this whole, like, fat is the worst thing in the entire world is just, it's so programmed now. That's what everyone thinks. And it's hard to unwire that from their brains. And you have the facts. Yeah. It's just no one's, I guess, seeing it, I guess. I feel like that's really it.
Yeah, and like I said, this work has been going on since the 60s. I'm one little voice in a big movement of amazing people. But I think the reason why it's so hard for us to be seen and to see ourselves is that we are taught from the earliest ages that a fat body is just a future thin body. This idea of pathologizing fat bodies tells fat people, like, your body is wrong. And we're encouraged to, like, make lists of things we're going to do when we're thin, to put our life on hold, that nothing is something that we should be doing except trying to become thin. And then we can try to pursue things in our lives. And so people spend, and of course, like we said, most people are going to lose weight short term, gain it back long term, over and over again. So I heard from someone who said her mom was on her deathbed, and she had always been really, her mom had always really been against her size acceptance and health at every size practice. And her mom said, I never did anything, you know, and I'm so proud of you. And I'm so glad that you chose this. And like, she's on her deathbed realizing she spent her whole life trying to be, never achieved that in any long term way. And so never did the thing she wanted to do in her life. And that's what makes me want to do this work, just to tell people, like, look, there are options. Like, you don't have, there are options besides pursuing thinness as a way to achieve your goals. And like, the big realization for me was that weight stigma is real and weight stigma harms me. And that's not something I can change overnight. So what I had done for years was fight my body on behalf of weight stigma. And what I realized was that I could instead fight weight stigma on behalf of my body. And that I was going to have to fight either way. I would rather fight weight stigma than fight my own body. And so that was the decision that I made. But I think too often we overlook the fact that we can't self-love our way out of systemic oppression. So I can't, like, I can love my body all I want, but it won't make me fit in a chair that doesn't accommodate me. It won't give me protection from an employer who wouldn't hire me. And of course, that this is worse for people at higher weights and people with multiple marginalized identities. So someone who's fat and Black and trans is experiencing all these things together, fat and disabled people. There are all these ways that Kimberly Crenshaw's framework of intersectionality informs this whole perspective. And so that's really hard to do, because we try to, in some ways, I think people act like self-love is the end. And it's like learning to love and appreciate our bodies, learning how the diet industry and is constructed and harms us is great, but like, it doesn't solve systemic oppression. We have to solve these problems systemically in order to really create a world where fat people can thrive.
Yeah, there has to be a reformation for sure. Absolutely. I'm truly trying to get to that point. But again, like you said, it's a journey. Like, you really have to take the time. And like you said, you're just one person, and having a whole community like us to come together and be able to help support, but not only provide that information, is, it's like the next step. And I hope we find some point where we can get that reform. We can get that weight discrimination bill nationally. That'd be great. I would love to see that kind of stuff. I know you basically said you always had that confidence, and you've always seen yourself like you can actually handle everything, but you've probably had some challenges in your younger self and stuff like that. What advice would you give your 18-year-old self? Because you said you did trouble with dieting and all that.
Yeah, don't diet is the advice I'd give. Don't even start. because I ended up devolving into, at around 18, into an eating disorder. My friend's mom, my junior year of high school, I'm sure she was really well-meaning, but she was like, oh, you're going to lose that weight. Like, you don't want to go to college fat, do you? And that was my first, I really need to, because I was always a bigger kid, but I was also a pretty successful athlete and I didn't get as much body shaming as I might have otherwise. Again, that like good fatty privilege kind of thing. But yeah, and that devolved into an eating disorder. And then coming out of that, I was still in like a body that was quote unquote too big. So I was like being treated for an eating disorder and being told by my doctors that I needed to lose weight to be healthy. And I remember a doctor saying, don't go crazy like you did before, but you're a naturally bigger person. So you're just going to have to worry about this your whole life. Which is not what we tell someone recovering from eating, like not what we tell anyone, honestly. And I wish I had realized in that moment, like the truth of that was you're a naturally bigger person. Yeah. Had I been able to see that for what it is as clearly as I can now, my life would have been drastically different. But I was just like, yeah, okay, got it. Yep. Some people just have to really diet their whole lives hard. And I can do that. Like I'm that type A personality. Only 5% of people succeed. That's not a problem. I'll be the 5%. It's fine. A really unhealthy way to look at that and really kept me in diet culture and messed up my relationships with food and movement and my body in ways that took a long time to repair.
Yeah. I feel the same way too. There were so many missed opportunities that I can never get back. And I feel like I should have just started living. Like I talked to this one guest and she was like, I had missed opportunities where she was like, I was supposed to go on a boat, like party with somebody, but I never went because I thought I was too fat to wear the swimsuit. And I was like, me too. Mm-hmm. Me too. And it's just, heartbreaking. Cause I was like, just wear the damn swimsuit. Like it's not going to kill you. It really isn't. And if someone has an opinion, I just like, tell them to fuck off, but that's just me. Yeah.
I was just going to say, I look back at the harm I did because part of how I worked my way through college was as a fitness instructor. I got my first fitness certification in 1996 and I was 100% in diet culture and really using it to cover up my eating disorder because the only way it's normal to spend the kind of time that I did at the gym was if you were an instructor employed there. And I know a lot of people who did. And so when I think about what I taught my classes and the way that I encouraged people to hate their bodies and to work out to be thin, like I've done, I feel like part of the activism now is just to try to unwind some of the harm I did with the platform I had when I was in eating disorder and fat phobia and diet culture. So yeah, I did. There's a lot of things. Had I not gotten on that diet culture train in the first place, I would have done a lot less harm to myself and to other
people. I know. I wish the diet culture would give me a refund for all the money I spent, but I know I'm never going to get that money back. It's such a waste.
Seriously.
Such a shame, honestly. You said you've really taken on like this whole speaker journey, athlete journey, everything. But I know that's not easy just finding that kind of influence and getting that confidence. Is there any like type of influential people that kind of gave you that kind of confidence to take off?
Oh, there are so many. I was thinking about this. Yeah, it's so hard to narrow it down because I will leave people out. I will always say my mom. Because like I said, I was not the easiest child. If something didn't seem right to me, it didn't matter if it was me and the third grade teacher, like we were going to have it out about it. And I felt like I had every right to speak my mind and to be heard. And so my poor mom was in the principal's office constantly with my problems with authority. And I led a protest and I did this or that. And she could have very easily tried to tone that down in me. And taught me like, this isn't how we act and we have to respect authority figures. And she did not. She would be, I remember her being in the principal's office and the third grade teacher said, well, Reagan corrected something I had on the board. And the principal was like, you can see that this is a problem. And my mom was like, was she right? And the teacher was like, that's very much not the point. And my mom was like, I think that very much is. And so like in front of me, in front of adults, my mom had my back always. And so not everybody has that kind of luck and privilege like I did. And I think that really helped to form me into somebody who was like, I do have every right to be heard. And no matter who I'm talking to and no matter what authority they're supposed to have. And so there's that. But there's so many people, I don't want to like name because you forget people, but people whose writings are in the book Shadows on a Tightrope. Incredible, like, fat activists from the early days, the fat underground, all of those folks, people who I was really into studying various civil rights movements in school. And so there are so many people like when I was in like elementary and middle school. And so there are so many people who led different civil rights movements, many of which I have the privilege not to have had to benefit, whose work I found really incredible and really inspirational. Anybody who has the courage to say this isn't right and I'm going to speak up about it in whatever way I can is an inspiration to me.
I love it. It's hard to narrate and like narrow it down, but I completely get it. Sometimes it's just there's so many people in your life that come and go that just leave such an impact on you that you cherish it. But like you, again, you still cherish that. It's just you may not name drop them, but you're always thinking about them.
Yeah. And my mom, by the way, still to this day is like that. Like when I started doing Health at Every Size and Size Acceptance, she was like, all right, let's go. Like my mom still to this day just constantly has my back, and I'm so lucky and grateful.
Oh, that's amazing. Can I have a piece of that, honestly?
Sure, she'll adopt you. My mom has tried to adopt any number of my friends over the years, so just say the word.
Like, I love that. Yeah, I very much need that kind of relationship. Oh my God. This has been Reagan Chastain, everyone. Is there anything you'd like to promote or send up that you're doing?
So before mine, there's something I kept thinking to mention and then it kept not doing it. Saucy West is doing a project to fight for inclusivity in fat fashion. And it's incredible. So I highly recommend like finding her online on social media, supporting that project. It's hashtag fight for inclusivity and Saucy, S-A-U-C-Y. So I kept meaning to mention that and kept failing. So that in terms of my own work. So I started a newsletter specifically about the intersections of weight science, weight stigma, and healthcare. And so it's on Substack. It's called Weight and Healthcare. Substack.com. And then my blog that I started in 2009 is Dances with Fat. And from there, you can find like all of my social media links are on there and a link to the newsletter. So that's a hub that people can start. And on there, you can also find I do monthly workshops and then I keep videos of them and they always have a pay what you can option. And so all the videos do as well. So people can take a look at that if they're looking for some support that way.
Yes, guys, check that all out. I was looking at your monthly workshop and I believe you have fat phobia or ending fat phobia for the holidays. And I was like, where was that 5 years ago for me? Honestly, that would have saved a whole conversation for me. Thank you. So you guys definitely check that out if you feel like you're going to be struggling for the holidays. She is the one to go to. Thank you so much for being on here.
Oh, thank you for having me and for all the work you do. Seriously, it's an honor.
Thank you. I'm one day at a time. That's really what I'm doing because I'm still trying to figure it all out. Thank you for listening to this episode of Expand the Curve. Leave us a review and tell us what you think. You can keep up with the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Expand the Curve. If you want to support the podcast with a monthly donation, visit our Patreon. We appreciate your support.